This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Friday, November 27th, 2020. I'm Caleb Brown. Abolitionists in the 19th century themselves differed largely on whether the Constitution was, at its core, a pro-slavery or anti-slavery document. Frederick Douglass, for his part, held both views at different times in his life. Damon Root is author of the new book, A Glorious Liberty, Frederick Douglass and the Fight for an Anti-Slavery Constitution. We spoke earlier this month. Set the stage for us here. Frederick Douglass, the great orator, writer, American thinker, I think it's almost fair to think of him as like the final founder in a way, the way that he presented ideas, and absolutely bold in his pronouncements about how the world works and how people ought to think about things. Who were his allies in trying to understand the Constitution as it existed in a particular way, and what changes were needed to it, if any, to remedy the great crime of slavery?
So for the first decade of his career as an abolitionist, Frederick Douglass is a self-described faithful disciple of William Lloyd Garrison. And Garrison's the great Massachusetts abolitionist, founder and publisher of The Liberator, the extremely important abolitionist newspaper. And Garrison's view is that the Constitution is a covenant with death and an agreement with hell. It's a pro-slavery document drenched in human blood. And Garrison thought that abolitionists should have nothing to do with the Union, nothing to do with the Constitution. He wanted the northern states, the free states, to secede from the Union. No union with slaveholders. That's the motto that adorns the Liberator. And that is Frederick Douglass's view for 10 years, his first 10 years as a professional abolitionist, the man giving speeches, writing articles, going out on the stump. But Douglass starts to rethink the Garrisonian position. He moves out of Massachusetts when he starts his own newspaper, the North Star. He moves to upstate New York, and he falls in with a group of people. They were called the political abolitionists sometimes. These are the folks involved in the founding of the Liberty Party, abolitionist political party. And so you have Gerrit Smith, New York landowner, very important philanthropist and funder of abolitionist causes. And Gerrit Smith saw the Constitution as a weapon that the anti-slavery movement could use. He said, you look at the Constitution, it's full of these wonderful principles of liberty and equality. And of course, the word slavery appears nowhere in the Constitution. And so Douglass says that it's because he moves to New York State, he starts to encounter these other views, he's challenged by them, and he's thinking about them, and he basically conducts his own deep study into the constitutional history text, the writings of the founders, and he has basically a complete change of mind. He says that interpreted as it ought to be interpreted, the Constitution is a glorious liberty document, and it is our weapon, the abolitionist weapon, to abolish slavery in every state of the Union. So he goes from the Garrisonian view of basically that the Constitution is an evil compact to this idea of it as a purely document of liberty that absolutely should be wielded by the anti-slavery forces.
In this sort of transition that Douglass makes, how much of that is purely intellectual? How much of that is practical?
Well, one of the things Douglass says as he's basically in the late 1840s, 1847, 1848 is when he's really starting to grapple with these ideas. And he comes to this realization. He says, you know, William Lloyd Garrison and John C. Calhoun, they look at the Constitution and they both see the same thing, a pro-slavery document. And Douglass starts to get tired of it. Was, as the way he puts it, is I don't want to keep putting an oar in the water on the slaveholder side, making the same kind of argument essentially that Calhoun is making. So I think that that's something that's in his mind, but it's absolutely an intellectual development. One of the people who's most influential in Douglass's thinking is this radical abolitionist named Lysander Spooner, and he writes a book in the mid 1840s called The Unconstitutionality of Slavery, and this is the most thoroughgoing exposition of the argument that the Constitution can and should be used for anti-slavery purposes, and that there's no sanction for slavery within it when you really look at the language and the absence of the term slavery. And Spooner says that the test is if someone who had no knowledge of the existence or non-existence of slavery, no knowledge of American history, essentially just came, you know, an alien out of space came and read the Constitution, would they think it was pro or anti-slavery? And they would think it was anti-slavery because there's no sanction for it, the term's not there, et cetera. And this is in the mid-1840s, this is a huge debate between Spooner and Gerrit Smith on one side, and then William Lloyd Garrison, and then his lieutenant, Wendell Phillips, both the Massachusetts abolitionists. And Wendell Phillips writes basically a book-length attack on Spooner's book. So these things are out there and are being read and being debated. And Douglass follows this very closely, studies these debates. And you can look at his letters. And I talk about this in the book, his letters, his private correspondence, his speeches, his editorials. You can see him grappling, you know, in real time, essentially, with these arguments. And he doesn't change his mind overnight by any means. It takes him several years, and he really broods and studies and thinks and wrestles with it. But then finally, by 1851, he's ready to go public with this new point of view. And at a meeting of anti-slavery activists, he announces his change of mind, and it basically causes practically a riot on the floor. Garrison denounces him. Garrison says that the only reason you changed your mind is because you wanted Gerrit Smith's money. Accuses of being, like a sellout and a, just seeking that kind of financial backing and being unprincipled. And so the two of them have a pretty nasty break. It's one of the uglier political divorces in American history. And I think ultimately, if you kind of fast forward to the era of when the Civil War breaks out, you actually see Garrison start moving towards the Douglass position, because the idea of pacifism, non-voting, non-involvement in the political process, the North seceding from the South and from the Union. I mean, all of those things are turned upside down by the Civil War, and Garrison ultimately ends up closer to where Douglass was. So I think Douglass, just as a historical matter, wins on that way.
You were talking about this uproar at a meeting, and I feel like I've attended meetings like this where some pretty bold pronouncements are made. And In my mind, a lot of those times I'm thinking, well, you guys are on the same side here. Why this horrible difference of opinion? And this, in some ways, it seems like a tactical issue, that it is whether or not somebody would reject the Constitution as a document. What was the real importance of coming to a resolution on whether or not the Constitution itself was an anti-slavery document when you see a civil war looming?
Well, on the one hand, Garrison is a pretty imperious fellow, and so he didn't brook dissent from his point of view. So there's, and also Douglass, his sort of former student, Douglass described Garrison as his mentor, and then Douglass starts to eclipse his former teacher in many ways. So I think there's a bit of personal disagreement there. That's part of it. But in practical terms, you have political parties, anti-slavery political parties starting to form. So you have the Liberty Party, then the Free Soil Party, and then that becomes the Republican Party. And the question of whether the anti-slavery people should be involved in those parties is hugely important. And Garrison and his allies have this view. It's a deeply moral, these are deeply religious people, but it's a deeply moral view that slavery is so profoundly staining that we can't have anything to do with it, and we have to fight it, but also from a position of great sort of moral purity. And so nothing to do with political parties, nothing to do with voting, and then of course the Constitution, which they see as the sanction for all of this. Certainly, I think history has borne out that the Douglass approach, which is to use politics and use the Constitution, that becomes what the Republican Party is all about in the 1850s, and Abraham Lincoln and Salmon P. Chase, who was Lincoln's Treasury Secretary, later Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, but probably the most important Republican legal theorist at that time. I think that it's pretty clear their views, is in a practical sense, certainly were the better way to go. But you can't discount the powerful moral arguments and moral fervor that Garrison stirs up. And so in a way, you looking historically at this, you see that both sides are necessary, that you need these radicals who are just so uncompromising. And they're like, and they are just, it's hellfire and brimstone, denouncing slavery, denouncing the Constitution. If you have anything to do with it, you're absolutely evil. You sort of need that. And Frederick Douglass is this figure who has a foot in both camps, like literally because of his evolution, but also even when he becomes a political abolitionist, he is preaching hellfire and brimstone against slavery also. His great speech in 1852, the 4th of July oration, where he says that, you know, there's no crime greater in history than what's happening right now in these United States. And that's why the 4th of July to Black Americans is this slap in the face, because we look at these principles of liberty and equality in the Declaration and in the Constitution, and then we see what we're experiencing. I mean, that is not a middle of the road, centrist kind of way to talk about issues.
Right. He was invited to address a crowd on what they believed was a great celebration. And he said, no, it's your celebration, not mine.
That's right. And so he bridges those two approaches and speaks to the radical abolitionists of the Garrisonian persuasion. I mean, they still have a lot of respect for Douglass. The break between Douglass and Garrison is pretty bitter, and there's a lot of recriminations for some time. But Douglass continues to be this great spokesman for the anti-slavery cause, and is much of a unifying force between these two factions as you probably could get in the 1840s, 1850s.
So what was the, I mean, obviously the Civil War, awful, horrific, very bloody war in U.S. history. What was the impact of that argument on the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments?
Well, one of the things that happens right at the end of the Civil War, just shortly after the Union victory is secured and Lee's surrender at Appomattox, is that the American Anti-Slavery Society has a big meeting, and William Lloyd Garrison and some of his allies, they say, well, it's time to disband the American Anti-Slavery Society. We have prevailed. We founded this organization three decades ago, and now we have achieved our goal. Slavery is dead and buried. It's gone forever. And Frederick Douglass was sort of not so quick to agree with that. He said, yes, slavery's gone, but we have to worry about all of the ways that the former slaveholders can start to re-enslave us, can start to just chip away at the things that have been won. And so he wasn't ready to let his guard down in the same way. And so the 15th Amendment was something that was near and dear to his heart. He thought voting rights were just one of the most important things that could protect the liberty of the freedmen and women. He also absolutely supported the 14th Amendment and its idea of national citizenship and national rights, that the Bill of Rights did not just bind the federal government, but binded the states. And so when the Supreme Court guts that in the Slaughterhouse cases in 1873, Douglass, there's this great letter, this great exchange between him and Gerrit Smith, where Douglass denounces the Slaughterhouse decision. So I think of Douglass as absolutely as a founding father, and the sort of the Civil War Reconstruction era second founding, as Eric Foner and others have called it. I mean, Douglass, I think, is one of the titans of that period. And so if you want to think of the anti-slavery legal and political philosophies that feed into the Reconstruction amendments, I think you have to look at Douglass as one of the architects, intellectual architects of those. And the fact that he's not a lawyer by training, he taught himself how to read. He liberates himself, teaches himself how to read, and then he goes on to teach the country all about the sort of true meaning of the founding and the Declaration and these principles that he always hewed so closely to. I think it's just remarkably inspiring that he's so important and influential in that way.
Yeah, he was the kind of person who there are few people in American history who understood, I think, self-ownership better than Frederick Douglass.
Oh, absolutely. He really took this, if you go back to your John Locke, this idea of self-ownership is sort of the origin of this natural rights liberal philosophy. I mean, Douglass took that idea and ran with it, and you can see in the way he's engaging with pro-slavery theorists like John C. Calhoun and George Fitzhugh and others, and Chief Justice Taney, author of the Dred Scott opinion, Douglass is always returning to those kind of bedrock liberal principles of self-ownership and individualism and the way that they course through the Declaration and the Constitution. And in fact, you find that the pro-slavery theorists who he's fighting with, you see them backing away from that tradition. In fact, John C. Calhoun explicitly repudiates John Locke. He repudiates Thomas Jefferson. He basically says that Jefferson, by introducing this idea of inalienable rights into the Declaration of Independence, it was a terrible mistake. We didn't need to do it. He said it introduced this sort of this germ that eventually bore poisonous fruits. And he's talking about people like Frederick Douglass and the abolitionists who took the Declaration of Independence, you know, at its word. So that's absolutely what I think. Douglass is one of the great proponents of Lockean liberalism in the 19th century. He's not always recognized that way, but I think that's so it's a key to understanding his thinking and what was and it's really a kind of just a solid line that runs through his thinking, even as he's at the having these different views on the Constitution. That's something that's always there.
Yeah, it's weird to think of somebody like Fitzhugh or John C. Calhoun or Taney as sort of post-liberal at a time when if they're moving away from these liberal ideas that and using them to defend slavery, it seems like they're both conservative and post-liberal.
Yeah, no, there's interesting. There's a lot of stuff that feels very contemporary in some of these debates because the debates about liberalism, we're having those again right now for sure. And but also debates about the Constitution and slavery's role in American history. I mean, this idea of is the founding just, you know, drenched in blood and evil and irredeemable. That, you know, that was the Garrisonian view. And that's not a new argument. And so the arguments that Douglass and Garrison have about the Constitution, about the founding, I mean, people are having those kind of debates right now. And that's one of the things that's really interesting in reading their exchanges and following it is to see that these are things that Americans fight about. I do think Douglass has some very, he's worth studying, he's worth reading, he's got some really, really powerful ways to think about this stuff.
Damon Root is author of A Glorious Liberty, Frederick Douglass and the Fight for an Anti-Slavery Constitution. Subscribe to the Cato Daily Podcast anywhere you please and follow us on Twitter @CatoPodcast.